Yeah, recording.
Recording?
Yeah, recording.
This is Mom's Basement Podcast, episode... Oh.
Fuck, what episode is it?
32.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, thanks, Alex.
I'm Googling it.
Yeah, I honestly had no idea what episode it was.
Nah, I lost track. When you only do one episode every 6 months or whatever the fuck it is now,
yeah.
It goes to show you how important they are, where it's only once every 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Each one's a collector's item.
Yeah, it's like you're the oracles.
Mm-hmm.
and it takes 6 months to be appeased.
Yeah.
Right. Come down from Mount Olympus, yo. Mm-hmm.
And pretty much.
Come out of our parents' basement is more like
it. Or that.
That's right.
Yeah.
However you want to call it. Yeah.
Right. So, I was going to say to our one listener, but our one listener is now on the podcast.
Yeah, he's here
to
right
our
now.
Zero listeners, we have a new host with us. Now.
Hey there.
Alex. Hey. Do you want to introduce yourself, Alex?
Oh, okay. Well, my name is Alex Slingle, and I am an avid fan of Mom's Basement, so they asked for people to come along and say hey, so I'm here.
Sounds good.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
In standard Mom's Basement fashion, I'm a little awkward about this.
No, that's
you
cool.
You still have more backstory and justification for being here than the rest of us.
Yeah.
Okay, what's up for tonight?
Well, you know, before we get down to business, Rudy asked me before the show if he could make a really important, serious announcement. And I know we like to dick around on this show. I know we like to joke around. We like to have fun. You know, but this is serious, and it has to do with love.
Yeah.
And you know, fuck me if I don't have a soft spot in my heart for a friend who's in love. So, Rudy, why don't you talk about that?
Basically, I just wanted to say that Dan Maruzchak is, like, a beautiful human being. And I'm just enraptured by Dan Maruzchak, almost. Might say fixated, but that'd be kind of creepy. But yeah, Dan, you have, like, a meticulous beard, and, you know, it just goes great with your personality. And yeah, that's about it.
Don't hold back, Rudy.
Oh,
keep
okay.
going.
Well, I want to hold
the love, Rudy.
I want to hold back a little bit because I'm not sure how he's going to take this. I wouldn't say like, "Oh, I want to fuck Dan Maruzchak" or something like that. I might not want to say that, but
I will say this. Dan Maruzchak is probably the most physically attractive podcaster that I've seen.
He is.
Now, granted, you know, judging by the Mom's Basement crowd, you know, we're not, the bar isn't high.
No.
But he's well over that bar. He has cleared that bar.
Yeah.
But anyway, we don't want to belabor this point because we know how, you know, sensitive and awkward love can be, especially new love, and love that if you don't know it's going to be reciprocated. Oh my god. You know, your heart must be a flutter right now. But
totally.
Okay, so getting down to business. before we actually begin, one thing I wanted to talk about is months and months ago, we were doing this thing where people could send us their games, and we would playtest them. And then we would send them the playtest audio and do a little critique of their work-in-progress game on the podcast.
Yep.
And now that we once again actually have more than two people on the podcast, we want to start doing that again.
Yeah.
Now, Greg Christopher sent us several of his games. We're going to pick one of them next week, play it, and then critique it on the podcast. But after that, you know, the schedule's empty. Slate's clean.
Yep.
So if you have a game that you worked on, and it doesn't, the subject matter doesn't matter, you know.
No.
If it's about three or fewer teen girls in love, sure. If it's about the Holocaust, you know, we've played that games about the Holocaust before.
Yeah.
If it's about, I don't know, gay sex on Mars, good, send it along.
Yeah.
The only thing is that now we're recording via Skype, so if your game has heavy LARP elements or uses, like, a checkerboard or uses, you know, things that have to be physically present in order to play, we're not going to be able to play your game.
Yeah.
And that's a shame, because the games that Rudy and I design are games that we wouldn't be able to play test on the podcast.
Yeah.
But that's just what our limitations are.
Yep.
Actually, I'm going to have to blow your guys' minds here.
Yeah?
You can do video calls on Skype.
That's true.
Oh, yeah.
So you can just blast the video over on your side, but then I'll be able to see where you guys live.
That's true.
That's cool.
So I'll be one step closer to finally visiting.
You should be more worried about us seeing where you live.
Yeah, see that.
What person I know who will never video conference with us now is Dan Ruzjack.
Oh. Well, I'm in the same state as him, so he'll have to be worried.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. He's in Eugene, isn't he?
Yeah. And I'm up in Portland.
Cool.
Oh, okay. So...
Right, moving on.
So anyway, if you have a game... Okay, so if you have a game with LARP elements or other crazy shit, send it to us, and we'll try to figure it out. No guarantees, but we'll try to figure it out. So you can send those things to momsbasementpodcast@gmail.com. That's momsbasementpodcast@gmail.com.
Yep.
Or you can drop a comment on the blog or something, and we will tell you where to send it to.
Yep.
Okay.
Very cool.
Very cool. Well... sort of cool.
Yeah, mildly cool.
More than cool, kind of chill.
Yeah, it's chill.
Ice cool.
Yeah. Ice
frozen.
Cool. Ice,
yeah.
Baby.
Absolute fucking zero.
Yep.
Okay, so...
Right.
Someone wanna launch into a topic here? Alex, I think you had something you wanted to talk about.
All right. Let's go with a subject here. Since this is my first time being on with you guys, I wanted to get some get a subject going that's kind of near and dear to my heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little thing called imagination.
Yeah.
Gonna blow your mind with it.
Whoa.
And the main thing I want to know is, how do you guys ever feel about it? Because I never hear people think about, you know, talk about imagination and, like, what it really is, because it can mean anything to anybody.
Yeah.
So I wanted to know, and the listeners, the zero listeners you have, they want to know what imagination means to you.
Yeah.
So okay. Would you like me to start out there first, so we have an understanding?
Yeah, you can start out.
You can start it.
All right. So whenever I talk about imagination, the most important thing to me is how it applies, like how the word applies to what you're doing. Because to me, imagination is when you take the unknown and you put it into what is known.
Mm.
Such as when you want to say, let's go with the theme of the night, you know, Nazis. When we talk about those, it's, you know, kind of boring, kind of horrifying, you know, all the tragic things they've done. But then, what if we take, like, the worst thing about them, like, you know, the whole, you know, killing of, you know, mass people, and then we replace it with something weird? Like, what if they were in charge of killing the dinosaurs?
I would play that game. I would play that game right now.
But the whole thing is, though, that changes the entire perspective on how we feel about them.
Right.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's what I'm talking about. To me, imagination is taking the unknown and putting it into the known.
Mm.
And, like, I have other examples, but let's just go off with that. Just, you know, on to one of you guys.
Right. Well, I think you have a point there, that imagination is fundamentally about perspective. You know, it's about, you know, it's about the capacity to to leave your narrow personal perspective and enter a different perspective. Whether that means, you know, a entirely different worldview, or whether it means just putting yourself into the perspective of someone else who is like you in every way but X.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, that's a uniquely human ability. You know, no other species has the ability to imagine even how other members of that species feel. You know, empathy is something that's uniquely human. And I think imagination is, in some crazy way, directly linked to empathy. Even if it's about the denial of empathy, you know, even if it's about imagining yourself to be someone who is much more antisocial and uncaring and horrible than you actually are, there's a step there where it's real. Empathy is something that you're modulating, that you're controlling when you're engaged in imagination.
Yeah, I'd pretty much agree with that. As far as role-playing is concerned, in a role-playing context, I think imagination is really not only the ability to come up with different people or empathize with different people, but also to maybe kind of imagine different worlds or different places. Like, you can imagine somewhere else where you are, or you can imagine a different situation that you're in. And that, especially with situation, that really seems to, for role-playing, that seems to be the thing now, you know, the go-to thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, basically the situation kind of inspires the role-play, or that kind of deal.
Right. Well, and that's an interesting question, isn't it? And it's one that doesn't get debated directly very much, is whether role-playing is fundamentally about being inspired by situation, by character, or by setting.
Yeah.
That seems to be, and every little click, every little design movement seems to have a fundamentally different perspective on this. You know, if you look at the story games crowd, most of them are really, an implicit assumption of their game is that situation
is the
primary form of inspiration for role playing.
Right.
If you look at the Jeeps, you know, if you look at the Jeep forum players, it's that character is the fundamental motivator, to the point that they're willing to say something like, you know, setting is irrelevant or setting is secondary.
Right.
And situation, even, in some ways, is, well, Jeep, you know, in Jeep, the situation is fixed.
Right.
And it's fixed as a way to explore character. And then, of course, if you look at D&D, and especially the White Wolf games, their argument seems to be that setting is the major, you know, source of inspiration for role-playing.
Right.
Well, I think a lot of the lack of conversation has to do with how personal those subjects are, because it's such a vague subject.
It is.
Since the idea is infinity, that's pretty much what it is.
Right.
Like, how do you apply it? So I think that could be like the main reason why no one really talks about it, but they have their own take on how they think it should work. They just don't say, this is how my imagination works.
That's true. But, I mean, I think a failure to question that can cause some run-ins in your group, you know?
I mean,
there are some people who would actually say that the mechanics themselves inspired your imagination during gameplay. And I don't think that's a totally wrong conclusion to draw. But if you have a group, you know, say four people, and each of them is expecting the inspiration to come from a different place.
Right.
That can cause some real conflict within your group. And especially if it's a game that has a DM, that can be hellish for the DM.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can be... you can be trying to provide, say, interesting opportunities for character development for one player while trying to cultivate an interesting plot, you know, an interesting situation for another, while trying to drop as many little cute setting details as you can for a third player. Meanwhile, the fourth player is like, oh, I haven't been able to roll the dice in like 50 minutes here. What's going on, bro?
Yeah. That happened to me in a Star Wars game where I came from the playing field where the DM was in charge of throwing things at you,
mm-hmm.
and responding to see, like, you know, this is how creative I am in handling the situation, because I don't want to disrupt what that person's trying to do, because I come from the game style of where the DM is kind of in charge of mm-hmm. where we're going to kind of go, not like complete railroading, but hey, today we're doing this, don't really screw it up too much.
Right.
And the Star Wars games that I had was a Firefly Star Wars game, and the entire thing had to do with conflict amongst the people.
Hmm.
But I know, I just don't want to really cause conflict, because I hate conflict when it comes to other people. I'd rather just kill them or walk away. And it made it very difficult. And then what made it even worse was because my character was supposed to be an officer, but the DM purposely did not allow me to be the leader.
No,
so all my stuff that was related to my persona in the game, but just completely, you know, all the stuff that was supposed to help me bring my, you know, my imagination, my foresight into it there, was completely taken away from me, so it just became very boring for me. I didn't use any of my skills that required me, you know, being an officer, because I felt that I was not being an officer at the moment.
Right.
And then I got heckled for it, for not using my abilities, you know, because for not bending the rules.
Mm.
Feel like I should use my officer abilities when I'm being an officer. All not, right. Oh, we're in the middle of this fight. You've never shown anything in your blood to show, like, any, you don't have any power whatsoever with this group, but for some reason you have powers with this group now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So the DM completely ruined my version of, you know, of trying to introduce imagination into the game.
Hmm.
Like, and I even did like a suicide charge for the group, because everyone was just stand still. But apparently he decided, oh no, that's what's going to get anyone killed. And I almost died doing that because I showed some bravery for my group.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's an interesting problem, and it's one that I've run into a lot, both as a DM and as a player. It's when the DM engages in tactical withholding is really the only way I can describe it. When the DM says, well, because my game is X, I'm going to withhold Y from the players. And I don't think that's necessarily 100% a bad thing, but if the DM doesn't explain clearly at the beginning of the game, okay, guys, you can't use this power, ability, class, race, whatever, magical item, because I am trying to do this, you know, I'm trying to accomplish this storyline, this is something that has to do with my setting, this is you know, whatever. Yeah. If you don't do that, if you're not upfront about that, it can be very frustrating for your players, because it totally undermines their expectations for the game.
Yeah.
Especially if it involves tactically removing some aspect of the game that's in the manual, you know, that's in the rules and that the players are expecting to see in the game.
Yeah.
And I can give two examples of this. One where I was the victim, and one where I was the perpetrator. One was a Thulutech game that I played in, and the DM decided that he thought that we should get or generate our character concepts by randomly selecting tropes from TVTropes.com.
Which was a good idea by itself.
Right. And I ended up with the Jar Jar Binks, you know, obnoxious support character trope. And we were playing Thulutech, so already there's some dissonance there. But So I was given that, so, you know, I played it to the hilt. I played an obnoxious, like, borderline mentally handicapped goofball character. And I also, my class also happened to be, oh, what's the one that has the big battle mech? I'm not too familiar with Bulu Tech. Rudy, do you remember?
Boy, what are they? It starts with an E, I think.
Well, whatever, they're the mech drivers.
Yeah, the mech, well, there's two mech drivers. There's the dudes that drive the little mechs, the little tactical mechs.
Oh.
And there's the dudes that drive the mechs with their emotions or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think I'd
would it be like empath?
Yeah, something like that.
Something it's kind of like... I know that's what they do.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was... I think I had the little tactical mech. Whatever the case
no,
was.
You had the big mech. I remember that. I had the tactical mech. Because I could still use mine inside. Bah.
Right. Well, anyway, so DM decided that after, you know, about an hour of prologue, we got to the place where the phenomenon was going down. And he decided, well, basically that my character was not mentally capable of using my battle mech. He's like, no, you can't have that. You'll disrupt the game with that, and in character, you're just too much of a goofball character to use that.
Well,
and
to go into a little more detail there, basically he was trying to go for a horror-type motif,
mm-hmm.
and it was set in a prison. Mm-hmm. So the idea was, you know, you're all trapped here, you're all kind of, you know, stuck in this situation.
Oh.
And, yeah, so you're gonna have to do this now.
Right.
And the mech kind of got in the way there, because I think we said, like, well, can we just blow up the prison with the mech?
But I was willing to play along.
Yeah.
I mean, as he gave me my mech, I was willing to, like, squeeze it inside the prison.
Yeah.
But he basically said, no, you can't have that. At which point I said, well, but... You know, all of my character abilities come from driving a mech around. So what am I supposed to do? And really, there's a breakdown on several points there. First, the extra little bit of material he decided to throw into the game in the form of character generation versus via TV tropes didn't mesh particularly well with the actual content of a survival horror game based on Lovecraft. With Max.
Well, what he didn't realize was his story that he wanted to do the isolationist, you know, the entrapment of some horror coming at you guys, did not mesh well with what you want with what was thrown at you, the TV tropes thing.
Right.
Because it totally could have worked, like, you know, break out of the prison and then you realize monsters are everywhere outside the prison.
Right, and you get in your mech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But, I mean, yeah, really, it was, you know, the scenario he picked for the game did not particularly well, did not match the rules, the mechanics of the game particularly well,
yeah.
Since being isolated in a small enclosed space does not work particularly well in a game where 3 out of 4 classes involve riding around in giant robots. And number two, the choice of character generation didn't match particularly well in that you can end up... I think I was the ethnic scrappy was what I was. You know, and that doesn't mix particularly well with survival horror. It was just... So the elements... weren't clearly thought. He didn't clearly think about how the elements would fit together beforehand, and he didn't clearly articulate how they were supposed to fit together to the group, and the end result was, you know, a mess. It was a bunch of different elements that didn't fit together, and players who were dissatisfied because they were like, I can't play what I thought I was going to play.
Yeah.
So to bring it all around back to the original thing, his narrow focus, his narrow imagination caused everyone to have a bad time because he couldn't adapt, he couldn't expand his horizons.
Right.
Yeah.
On trying to help everyone.
Right. And that's really the thing. If you're in a collaborative environment, your imagination has to be flexible. In a role-playing game, your imagination has to be able to accommodate the imaginations of everyone else at the table. And some people handle that better than others, I think.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's almost a skill that you have to cultivate, though. Because most new players, whether they're starting off with D&D or a White Wolf game or an indie game or whatever, aren't prepared for that. Even if they come from an environment rich in imagination, you know, even if they write short stories or poetry or make films or whatever, they're not prepared for that kind of collaborative use of imagination on the fly, you know. They're not prepared for having their imagination accommodate other people's imagination quickly and without disrupting or derailing the game.
Yeah,
because all those examples you gave were all, this is my imagination, and no one can stop what I have to say.
Right.
The RPG section is where it's collaborative. Everyone has to throw their ideas, and it comes to a point where how often are you going to deny someone else's imagination for yours?
Right.
Because that's the whole point of the DM, is to say no and to say yes. So when is he... And also the other players, depending on how your rule system is good, it could be a collaborative rule system where everyone agrees to something. How far are you going to deny somebody else's imagination for your own?
Right. And here's a question building off of that. To what degree is that relevant to game design?
I think that's pretty important.
Yeah.
I think it's a real question to ask, because there are a lot of games... especially within the indie community, that are designed primarily as the work of a single imagination. And a lot of the work that goes into the games is refining the game to best meet the ideals or the concept that initial creator had. You know, it's one person having an idea and then trying to refine that idea, much in the same way that you would write a work of fiction. And I'm wondering, should there be more space in the design process to accommodate other people's imaginations, the future, you know, the potential imaginations of your players, or, you know, your hypothetical players?
Right.
Or if really that kind of tightly focused one man's vision version of game design is superior.
Rudy, what do you think about it? I have something to say, but I want you to get something in.
Well, I think that for certain games, the tightly focused, you know, thematic and, you know, whatever they're trying to build with the game, I think that style appeals to some players, and some players it doesn't appeal to. Some players want a more open, you know, throw shit at the wall type of game. And when you're designing, I think it's important to figure out first what you're designing. What type of game, you know, is it that you want to bring? Is it going to be a really open, collaborative game, or is it going to be something that's more focused and where you really have to have the right mindset and you have to get the players in the right mindset to play your game?
All right. Whenever I've read indie books, like, speaking of, like, you know, the whole personal story there, like, majority of the indie books I've ever read were all just short stories with some RPG rule added into them. Like, you know, like Apocalypse World, that just felt like a short story that the person just added some RPG rules to it. You know, just small examples like that. So, if it works for some people, it works for some people. But the idea of, like, I don't think they're too far and few between like RPG games and just short stories. Of this is my direction, this is my narrative of how I feel this game should go. And this is the story behind it. Now I'm gonna throw it at you, and you can choose whatever you want with it.
Well, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well,
I mean, just personally.
Well, most of the games I've ever played, it's kind of worked out, but it's it's always been ruined by the people who take it too seriously.
Mm.
So I can say on both occasions it's been a good and a bad thing. I would say it's more bad than good. I would go like 60 bad, 40 good. You know, very close to where that single directive can kind of stifle people.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the collaborative work, because like if you ever like seen like some like maybe wasn't like some of the D&D books like where they had two or three people in charge of all the rules to get their collaborative work, you know, a lot of people like those rules because those two or three people worked together and said, hey, I have this one idea, and the number two guy goes, that's too restrictive, you know, let's work around doing something else.
Right.
Meanwhile, the people who have the one-man armies, you know, of PDF building or, you know, just game design in general, they don't have that person saying no to them. That's kind of ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah, so that's true.
It's the best and worst of things you can do is just being by yourself in your thinking process.
Right. No, I definitely agree with that, Rudy.
Well, I think that just like in traditional games where you have the problem of somebody taking the setting or whatever too seriously, in indie games and, you know, story games, a lot of times you have the issue of people taking the author too seriously, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
As far as, I mean, it's like what the author says is God. That's what you must do, but...
This is what he meant in his fifth journal that he wrote on his website.
Right. Yeah, and I mean...
He didn't put it in the book whatsoever, but I follow him religiously.
Yeah, right. But I mean...
On Vincent Baker's blog on March 17th at 11:01 a.m., he posted this, so...
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of the writing styles for indie games, they're really kind of... I don't want to say holding the player's hand, but they're really taking you through the steps...
Like authoritative?
Maybe? Authoritative, yeah. That's what they are. And that comes out of the, you know, the, I think, Forge-type game design theory, is that you should have your game clearly laid out, you know, and you should lay out clearly how to play it, and basically spell it out, spell out the experience, kind of. Which, I mean, for some people it might be a good thing if you want a highly focused experience. But if you want to kind of break that down partway through, you find you're not enjoying it, then you're kind of fucked.
Yeah, just hearing that idea of let me tell you how to have fun, that just like, you know, it's like sewage in my mouth. It's just,
I don't know. I'm really very conflicted about this, honestly. I really like, especially if you're playing a short-form game, I have to admit, I'm a big fan of deep form, and I'm a big fan of games, especially if they're designed to be played for 1-2 to 3 hour session, for games that, like, drop the concept in front of you, you know, this is what the game is, this is the scenario, here are some ultra-light, super simple rules, for this scenario, and here's some scene structure stuff, so that you know scene X leads to scene Y, scene leads to scene Z, and now take that and do what you're going to do with it, you know? Yeah. I think that a tightly controlled environment can sometimes really lead to some cool creativity, because it especially, I think, with new players, or with people who really don't do it a lot, it pushes all those initial obstacles aside, obstacles to creativity, like, oh, I need to come up with a character, or I need to pick five feats out of this list of 268 feats, and I need to roll hit points, and, oh, we need to talk about the setting, and I need to give some input on the setting, and I need to come up with a character concept and motivation, and, oh my god! Whereas, if you say, I don't know, I'll use an example from one of my own games. You're a racist white man in the antebellum South, and you think there might be a vampire in your group of racist old white men, but there's actually also a member of your group is a black man who is passing as white.
A darkie.
Let's deal with that. You know, let's... And then people know, oh, okay. So I know my character. I know what it's like. You know, I've seen old movies. I know what those racist white dudes in the South with their white seersucker suits were like, you know? And, oh, I got a card that says I'm hiding a secret about my family's history. Okay, so I'm going to come up with a quick secret. Boom, you're in the game. Or, mm-hmm. oh, I drew the card that says I'm secretly the vampire. Cool, I know how to play that. Or whatever, you know, you get it right away. This is what the game is. Now let's play the game.
Right.
Well, what I was thinking, though, is, because based off what you were going at, mm-hmm. it felt like what you were saying was sometimes, especially for new players, is that having too much freedom, having too much choice, can overwhelm them to the point where they just pick nothing at all.
Right.
And that by having that authoritative point, mm-hmm. Where you say, you are this guy, just deal with it.
Right.
It can allow the new people to understand what they're doing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or force an old player to leave their comfort zone.
Oh.
That's another thing.
Yeah.
Some people would never play a character like that. If they draw the character, if it's randomly assigned to them, or if the situation is something they would never in a million years imagine themselves playing and they're thrown into it, sometimes that forces them to make creative decisions on the fly. But I don't think that game design is in any that method of game design is in any way inherently superior to other, you know, to more open, you know, to game designs that are more open.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think we ran that down.
Yeah, we did. I think so.
Yeah.
Unless Rudy has something to add about it.
No.
No, like the only thing that I have that I could possibly add to it was like spotting imagination, like in terms of like how you can enforce it on yourself.
Yeah.
Because like there the one story that I do know, because I actually spoke about this for, like, it was one of my little thesis things, so that's why it was, you know, it's kind of like, you know, one of my things that I like the most. Mm-hmm. But one of the examples that I gave during that thing was the guy who invented the Slinky. Because like when you think about it, big whoop. How is this like a great invention? And then we find out how he came upon it. Mm. We go like, oh, this is that whole idea of, you know, replacing, you know, taking the unknown, putting it into the known. He was supposedly, this is what I remember, so I could be wrong. In case any of the super nerds out there want to tell me I'm wrong on the internet.
Oh no,
that's right. But anyways, he was, I think he was an elevator repairman. And he would have to constantly, like, you know, replace coils and stuff along the shaft line and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so one of these days, it broke down, like, you know, a few floors up. He was making his trip up there. One of the coils dropped, and it bounced along the stairs as he was, you know, as it was going down. And just seeing that, something that he doesn't really see that often, sparked that idea in his head to, hey, Let's, his kids laughed at the idea of him doing that when he told the story to his wife, and bam, he decided to make the Slinky because of that.
Yeah.
So yeah. Just by taking something that he just doesn't really do on a regular basis, which is drop coils, he usually has it in his bag or whatever.
Right.
That sparked the idea.
Right. Yeah, the idea that creativity and imagination is sometimes even accidental.
Yeah.
You know, and that you shouldn't be... Which I guess is an argument for a more open game design.
Yeah.
I mean, from what Rudy was saying about Forge Theory and from what I've read, there seems to be, not among all indie gamers, or all indie game designers, but among a certain population of them, a fear, of the accidents that happen in games.
Right.
This idea that if something unexpected happens in your game, or something provocative happens in your game, and it wasn't supposed to be there, that's a sign that the game is breaking down.
Yeah.
And watch out, because soon your group will start breaking down. And I think that that good players, and players who enter the game, you know, open to discovery,
right,
will often take those moments where the game starts to break down, or where something accidental happens, and say, holy shit, I can do something I never thought that I could never do before. In the same way that people will take computer games and find a bug and exploit it, so suddenly they're flying through the air, you know, or riding their horse through the air, or walking through walls, and it's like, holy shit, I could never walk through walls in this game before, and now I can.
Yeah.
And is that the game being broken or exploited, or is that just the game being, you know, used in a new way?
Yeah. Emergent gameplay, I guess.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I got nothing.
I got nothing either.
Okay. New topic?
Yeah.
Well, how much time do you got going anyways?
Oh, we're at 40 minutes now.
Yeah. Usually we shoot for about an hour.
Yep.
Okay. So, you said you had something?
I do not have anything.
Well...
Rudy, you said... Oh. Did you have anything you wanted to talk about besides your love for Dan Marustak?
No.
Besides that, we heard enough of it.
Yeah. I don't know, not a whole lot, but I guess to take a page from some other podcasts online that do irreverent stuff besides RPGs. Like nerd news type stuff.
Oh, okay.
To take a page from that, Diablo 3 is fucking coming out May 15th.
Yes, sir.
And that's awesome. So yeah, that killed some time.
No, what are you so excited about it? Because like I played Diablo 2, and I felt like I played it so much, I can't even bother to care about any future versions of it.
All right, well,
so
see,
that's why I was wondering, like, what's so special?
I don't know what it is that's so special about Diablo, but I just could never play that fucking game enough. Like, I played the shit out of Diablo and Diablo 2, and I still just can't play it enough. I can't get enough. If they re-release Diablo 2 with better graphics or something, I would probably buy that.
Wow.
I would probably
I've always liked the first one more than actually number 2, because number 1, even though it had crappier graphics, they were smart on how the resolution scale was, so it looked really good.
Yeah.
It did look really good for its time. Yeah.
Because it was pulled back as far as possibly could, so that way you couldn't see all the pixels.
Right.
Yeah.
I think from a game design perspective, I think there was... The gameplay in Diablo 2 was better polished. There was more there, it was more addictive, and so on and so forth. But Diablo 1 scared the shit out of me when I played it the first time. I mean, I don't think, aside from maybe the first time that I encountered a Hell Knight in Doom, I don't think I have ever been so ready to shit myself as I was when I encountered the Butcher in Diablo 1.
Oh yeah, the Butcher's room.
You open that door and the dude is flying at you and he has his meat cleaver out and you run because you think he's going to kill me.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't even try to fight him. You just try to run him out of the room and hope that he'll just die.
Yeah.
Diablo's the first time I ever had a nightmare from a game.
Really?
I'm just saying, it's that kind of, like, of course, the first Diablo one, just the artwork, the way they set it up. And they purposely did not try to do pseudo 3D crap when they couldn't do
no,
it back then.
No, exactly.
Yeah, I always loved it back then, especially like game companies who knew how powerful their machines were, or like who they were selling it to. They knew exactly what they were doing. The graphics were very crappy, but of course, because of the way they decided to hide those imperfections, they made it so much more. I want to say immersive.
Right.
Where you really felt like that monster is very scary, and you're going to crap your pants over it.
Right.
Because there was so much more detail added, when really there wasn't any detail. They just pulled it back to where you couldn't see the imperfections.
Right.
You saw this blob of something that was a little more, you know, something you can comprehend, and was just like, holy crap, it's a minotaur.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And it's kind of like the thing where something's scarier if, like, you can't tell exactly what it is.
Right. Yeah. So if you let your mind fill it in.
You let your mind fill it in, yeah.
Right. And scary in a way that no contemporary horror game is.
Yeah.
You know, nothing on the current gen systems will ever come close to scaring me as much as when you open that door and the butcher made that terrible noise and came running at you, you know?
Yeah.
But on the topic of, you know, that those tricks that they would use to hide graphical imperfections and games that actually use higher technology looking worse, I was watching video of Sonic CD the other day, and I don't know why but it looked terrible.
Yeah, it looks
and
like shit.
I remember how good Sonic 1 and 2 looked. Yeah. You know, you never really questioned the fact that, okay, it's pixelated or whatever. But Sonic CD, which was using, you know, somewhat better technology, and which had the capability to do, like, crude, like Alex mentioned, crude 3D shit.
Yeah.
It just looked abysmal. All the colors were washed out, and wherever they did 3D, it looked like dog shit. And you said, well, you know, the Genesis games were beautiful.
Yeah.
And this game, just, you know, half a generation later, looks terrible because they're trying to use technology that they haven't adapted to yet, that they don't have the capability to use well yet.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what happened with Sonic CD, honestly. I wanted to like that game because I like Sonic a lot.
Right.
But it just, I don't know, it was just the gameplay wasn't there as much as the other Sonics, in addition to the shitty graphics.
Right. Well, that was your point of departure from the Sonic series, right, Rudy?
Yeah,
the moment that you went from loving everything Sonic to hating it.
Pretty much.
So, with that in mind, there, because we're talking about Diablo 3 for a second.
Right.
Like, what is there anything in there that like shows promise to you wanting to play it?
Well, not really. But honestly, I just want to get some loot and kill some monsters and, you know, encounter some fucking big skeleton named Corpse Grinder, the Nigger Killer, or whatever. You know, I just want to encounter that. And, you know, just the goofiness of the game, you know. Mm-hmm. The stuff I remember from when I was a kid. And
have you ever heard of any, like, some of the news on there, like, some things that pissed you off about hearing about Diablo 3?
Originally the decision to have it be play online only was kind of and get rid of LAN play, that kind of pissed me off.
Yeah.
Are they still doing that, or is that...
Yeah, they're still doing that. Yeah.
It's okay, it's still going, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Honestly, I haven't been following Diablo 3 too much. I was addicted to Diablo 2, not as much as my sister, who was like, you know, it was like, you know, a serious drug addiction or something. I loved the original Diablo. I loved Diablo 2. I played them for hours and hours and hours. But the thing about, and I haven't been watching too closely, but the thing about Diablo 3 that I can't get over is I don't see anything there that justifies making me wait over a decade.
Yeah, see, that's a good point.
Yeah. Because, like, whenever Blizzard, because that's how they roll, yo.
Right.
Yeah.
And they take their sweet time, and they also do it on purpose. They don't do it because, like, oh, we're waiting for this to come along or something like that. They do it on purpose.
Yeah, they do.
Like, I forgot what it was. I think it was when StarCraft 2 was supposed to come out, and they said, oh, we actually have a few more bugs we have to take care of, so 6 months down the line, you'll be able to play it.
Yeah.
But then, if you had a brain back then, if you were paying attention to the stock market and all that kind of stuff, video games were down like 30% during that time period. So who's to say if they were being honest, and who's to say that they just wanted to release it later so that way they can pick up sales?
Right.
Crashed.
Yeah. Blizzard is a master at calculated withholding of pleasure. It's almost like some kind of Karma Sutra shit.
It's like
tantra.
Yeah, no,
that's
it's totally
stuff going on.
Exactly.
No,
see,
but
I don't really have much left for that, for those people, just because of just small stuff like that, where they purposely delay their stuff. Because they had the demo, they had people playing the beta test online during that time, it just was never officially out. So, like, that's, I don't believe them when they say they don't have it done.
Right.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Yeah.
And how much content is there to add? I can't imagine that a game that was already as carefully polished as Diablo 2 could have 10 years worth of additional, or 12 years worth of additional content to add, additional polishing to do, additional tweaking, additional, you know, and it still only has 5 classes.
Yeah.
Like, if I have to wait, I should get an additional class for each fucking year I have to wait beyond the 2 years that would be a normal development cycle. Yeah. You know, so I should have 10 classes, not 5 right now.
Well, yeah,
you,
no,
you are going to get addition class as DLC.
Yeah.
Oh, of course, yeah. See, that's
where they said day one DLC, where they're talking about, yeah, we're going to make this, and you're going to pay this extra character, too.
Yeah, and we will, too, because we love it, and we love to suck that dick.
Nah, I won't. I mean, as much as I love to suck a dick, I don't love downloadable content.
I will do anything for
DLC.
Love, but I won't do that.
Alright, hopefully no one spoke when you said that, so we can have that as a drop. As much as I like to.
Yeah.
Put that on your phones. Put that on your phones.
Mm-hmm.
But just to segue into something completely fucking different, and I can actually tie this back to pen and paper RPGs.
Okay.
So, get this. There's this game called Dear Esther. Well, actually, no, I won't say that. There's this thing called Dear Esther that's not really a game, but is like an interactive art project or something where you walk around an island and, I don't know, you have a torch and it comes out when it's dark and that kind of shit. But, I mean, what do you guys think about the idea of, like, pushing the medium so far, in any medium, even RPGs like tabletop, push the medium so far that it really isn't the same medium anymore? And I know this could be a whole fucking podcast basically on this, but...
And maybe it should be.
Yeah.
But... I don't know. Alex, what do you think?
Now, what exactly is going on in that Dear Esther thing?
It's basically, if you've, have you ever seen, like, The Graveyard or any of these other art-type games? They're, like, art games. They're not really games.
Okay, they're art. They're art games. That's
right. True. It's, like, interactive art. Sort
interactive.
Of.
Oh. Yeah.
Like the point-and-click games back in the day.
Almost.
Yeah, almost like
all
that.
It's really art, and you just really click on what it do.
Yeah.
Right. It is really basically like that, except those point-and-click adventure games had a higher level of interaction.
Yeah.
In Dear Esther, all you do is literally walk around this big island and listen to a guy talk.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'll point out clues that you can look at but can't interact with.
Right.
Oh, and as Rudy said, the height of interaction in this game is when it gets dark, a torch comes out.
Bam!
Now you can't control when you pull out your torch. You can't be like, I want to pull out the torch during the middle of the day. Well, no, fuck you, you can't. So what you do is you walk around this island as this guy narrates at you, and eventually it somehow his narration turns into a mystery, and that solves itself as you walk around.
Yeah.
No, this is not a game.
Yeah,
this is a visual presentation of a museum.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's
exactly what it is.
That's basically what it is, I think.
Alex, you just passed the mom's basement test.
Yeah.
I knew it was something. What the hell?
Rudy poses something like that, and then if you had said that was a game, I don't know if you and Rudy would ever have been able to speak to each other.
So the only way I can equate that is like maybe like the Myst series, but even then that had more interaction.
Myst had puzzles. They were just abysmal puzzles, but you could still like click on the books in the library and decide when people spoke at you.
Yeah, but I don't know.
I think that represents the apex of tabletop RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
Of the kind where you don't really have much of a choice. It's just, when are you going to die?
Yeah.
Because have you ever played that? I think it was called Dread or something like that, where you,
oh,
whatever
where
you
have
do,
the tower.
Matter, you just pick out a piece.
Yeah, yep. I actually think that's kind of cool, but Maybe it's just because of the Jenga mechanic. I don't know, but...
Well, but the whole point is you're not really in charge of when you go, or you don't really have any power whatsoever. It's just when you mess up.
Right. No agency.
Right.
Yeah. So I can just say I'm going out the I'm going to jump off the window on my my first story building. I screwed up. How did I die in this one?
Yeah. And I
pulled the wrong block card.
And I think in that game, there's actually some mechanic where, like, if the tower is going to fall, you can push it over, and then you get to at least narrate how you died, but I can still see your point. Because it's kind of like... But as far as indie games, it seems like the lack of agency thing is kind of a big deal for a lot of indie games. And, I mean, that's just something... I mean, not from me, not coming from an indie background, that I see. I mean, who the fuck does come from an indie background? I mean, most of these designers still talk about D&D and fucking, fourth edition and shit on the forum. So it's like, I mean, I don't know.
I've always equated the indie people with the modern hipsters.
Yeah.
Dude, we know so much about RPGs. We can't bother telling you about it. It's not even close to your family's D&D.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to rip on the indie community too much, but I
love them. I love them.
Yeah.
I have the love for them.
I do think that... I don't know. I don't know that I see quite the strong parallel there that perhaps you do. I definitely agree with you about something like Dear Esther or all of these Tale of Tales games. Right. When it comes to a video game... The medium is interaction, and right. That's something that you shouldn't forget.
Right.
It's like film. When film, and there's a close parallel here with video games to film, when film first came out, all films were about the medium of film.
Right. And,
they were about, all films were inherently visual because there was no sound. Right. So people were really exploring what film as a medium in and of itself could do, because you couldn't use it to tell exactly the same kind of stories you would in a novel, because you didn't have language, or you had title cards,
right?
And so you had to use very limited language. And then the talkies came along, and people started to treat film like a visual novel.
Right.
And it took the medium a while to figure out that, no, there's still a lot that you need to do visually, You can't lose the filmness of film. No. In that same way, I think that when video games first came out, the game, the interaction, was all there really was. Because the graphics looked like shit. Maybe you could tell a story, but the story was the princess is in another castle, That's continuity. And so, but then games have evolved, so now they can include voice acting, they can include highly realistic cutscenes, they can include, pseudo-interactive moments.
Highly realistic, unskippable cutscenes.
Right? Yeah. That's realistic, my friend.
Yeah.
And so I think now you're at that point where video games are desperately trying to imitate other mediums instead of focusing on the gameness of video games. But I don't know how to make that parallel to RPGs, since RPGs have from the beginning been a medium that is about, mechanical play, but also just as much about storytelling, just as much about, setting exploration.
Yeah.
The creative element, the game element, and the exploration element have been there from the beginning, and it just seems like people are modulating that, choosing how much of each element to include in their game, and that doesn't seem like a betrayal of what RPGs are fundamentally.
No, I don't think it is, but, let me just give an example kind of what I'm thinking of, and I hope I don't offend anybody by saying this, but an example of a game would be a game. Let's say there was a game that half of the game was a cookbook. Half of the manual was a fucking cookbook.
Yeah, okay.
Let's just say that game exists.
And let's say that that game also deals with Wuxia and... and
see, I didn't want to offend anybody here.
Okay. And let's say that that game isn't called Mistral Gate.
But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I love the idea of the game, and I love... I mean, it's a brilliant game, but it's just that... I mean, are we really at the point where we have to... where the experience, the game experience, is so much more than the game that we have to prescribe, you know, what color dumplings you can eat or whatever? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me like... You know, I mean, I understand why he did it that way. You know, it's to enhance the experience. And again, it's the difference, you know, in a focused experience and a more open one where, you know, everybody brings whatever snacks they want and that kind of thing. But I mean, I don't know. It just rubs me funny when, you know, you got a 40-page manual and half the manual is like a cookbook.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that bothers me and is when 50% of a manual is atmospheric content.
Right.
And this isn't just an indie thing. This is pathologically present in
White Wolf.
And I mean, is it necessarily better to have 50% of your manual be a complex history of 6 or 7 different vampire clans? And some of this content that you're actually encouraged not to include in your games because it's just there to provide background, just there to provide atmosphere.
Yeah, you can't kill the Vukulad because he's so badass. He's just there to, like, you know, to be badass.
To intimidate you when you're reading the manual and to not be mentioned in the game because even to mention his name, you know.
Sacrilege.
Right. Yeah. That bothers me, and I think that there is a rough parallel there to having half of your manual be a cookbook.
Yeah.
When there's this idea that so much of a manual should be devoted to getting you mentally into the space that the designer imagined you should be in before you play the game.
Right.
And I don't think that, and I think that's more like, in a lot of ways, it's damage control for the designer more than it is real inspiration for play.
Mm.
In that, the designer imagines, I want my game to go like this when it's played. Mm. But oh my god, what if people don't play it like this?
Right.
Well, I need to give them so much content, so much inspirational content, so much atmospheric content, that they have to play how I play because they're drowning in, like, this pool of me, you know?
I don't know.
They're overwhelmed by all the stuff that you're throwing at them. So they have to pick what you're doing. Isn't that like a type of what is it, like, where you try to hypnotize somebody, you overwhelm them?
Sensory overload type. Right. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
where you overload them in order to make them do what you want.
just as a polite request here, please. I hope that nobody takes the comment I made about liking to suck dick and then combines it with the drowning in the pool of big comment.
Oh, dear.
This is just part of the cinema verite.
Yeah, cinema verite. Dan Roostat really had a good point there. Cinema verite.
I think it's right. I think that's the most appropriate description of this podcast possible.
Fucking shaky cam, you know. Maybe it's in black and white sometimes because we couldn't afford film. But yeah.
But I guess, going back to the subject, I think that when you design a game, you shouldn't have too much content that is tangential to play. And I know trying to figure out, oh, is this superfluous or not,
is an
impossible task, you know, and it's different for everyone.
Yeah.
But if a lot of what you're including in your book is a lot of that atmospheric content, that stuff that isn't going to have a real nitty-gritty, tangible effect on play, then maybe you need to adjust where your book places its emphasis. Like, right. If Mistro, not to beat on Mistro,
we're going to beat the shit out of this game so much.
I haven't looked at it too closely, but using it as a hypothetical example, you know, if 5 of 40 pages were suggestions for food, I think that would be cool.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I don't know exactly how many pages it is. It's probably not literally half the manual, but half the manual is stuff like, you know, what movies you should watch and what things you should do to get yourself in the mood for play. And that just kind of brings up the point of, like, well, how much should we prescribe for play?
Right.
You know, to get the experience we want or we think we want.
And that would make an excellent appendix, I think, coming at the end of the game
as
supplemental content. But to front-load your game with, have these experiences, and then you'll be ready to play my game, is not...
Yeah.
I don't know. It is presumptuous, I think, in some ways. Is assuming that your game has this kind of inherent value that people need to prepare themselves in order to experience it. And I don't...
Yeah. I don't know.
Oh.
Well, we're encroaching on an hour right now. Well, we're actually over an hour.
We're over an hour?
106.
So you want to wrap this up then?
Sure.
I got nothing else to say right now.
I really don't have much to say either.
any final thoughts?
Not really. I mean, other than... Oh yeah, Calan S. have my babies. That's the usual thing that I say at the end.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know, Calan might be getting a little jealous now.
Yeah, I know, because, I mean... Calan, I didn't mean to put you on, like, the sideboard here with my... expressing my love for Dan Maru's chat. I just felt that I had to get that out. Get it out in the open. Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much he's going to appreciate the affair you're having with Dan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if he can't take it, then you know what? You know, fuck him. Because
well, I mean, you don't want a jealous lover to come at, you know, Dan, because...
Oh, yeah, no. No, I totally wouldn't want that.
Okay.
No, but...
Oh, my God. Okay. I'm just imagining, like, a deranged Calan ass with that Australian accent. You know, he's got the Skull Soldier mask on from Dan Skull Soldier. Oh my god, Jesus. We've alienated everyone in the indie community tonight.
Oh yes, we have. Oh dear.
Oh.
Yep.
Alright, so, why don't you, get, you know, do the wrap-up section, and then let's get this out of here.
Okay. Well, next time, hopefully we'll have played one of Greg Christopher's games, and we'll have commentary on it, and we'll talk about some other random shit, probably.
Yep.
What do we usually say at the end? Is there
Mom's
something we
basement.
Say? Oh, Mom's basement.
Yeah, Alex, just for the rundown here, usually our wrap-up section includes, like, Have we turned the camera off? Is it still on? That's about all we do. So we tend to end pretty abruptly, I guess. So
yeah. Okay.
We don't have a real, you know, wrap up. There's no outro music. There's no, you know, fancy shit.
Well, what I meant by wrap up, as in like saying, okay, we're done for today.
Oh yeah, yeah.
This is what we're gonna be doing next week. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Man, Rudy, have you found the stop button on Audacity yet?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, hey. Has it stopped recording?
No, I haven't.
Well, yeah. That's it.
Yeah. Okay. All right, bye. That's it. Don't listen anymore.